Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobby Jean Schweitzer, an associate editor for Anesthesiology, and you are listening to an Anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of publications that will appear in the October 22 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. John Fiaggio. Dr. Fiaggio is the senior author of an article titled, Sedation versus General Anesthesia for Tracheal Intubation in Children with Difficult Airways, a cohort study from the Pediatric Difficult Intubation Registry. Dr. Fiaggio is professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and Critical Care and Pain Medicine at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, both in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dr. Fiaggio.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a big consumer of podcasts, so I'm really excited to have this discussion with you.
Wonderful that you can participate today. And joining Dr. Fiaggio is Dr. Alan F. Simpow. Dr. Simpow, along with Drs. Clyde Matava and Andrew Davidson, wrote in an accompanying editorial, Walk a Tightrope or Burn a Bridge? Sedation versus General Anesthesia for Intubation of a Pediatric Difficult Airway. Dr. Simpow is Associate Professor of Anesthesiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, both in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Dr. Simpow.
Thanks so much for this honor. It's great to be here.
Dr. Fiaggio, let's start with you. I must say I was a little bit surprised about the hypothesis of this study. I believe you wrote, quote, sedated and awake tracheal intubation approaches are considered safest in adults with difficult airways. However, then you hypothesized that sedated intubation would be associated with a lower first attempt success rate and more complications than general anesthesia in the study of children. Why did you think there would be differences between the adults and children?
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. I think in PEDS, we always say that children are not small adults. And one of the mantras when I was training was that, you know, a sedated intubation in a child was impossible. It was one of those, we have certain impossible things that we talk about, and this was one of them, that the sedated child was not feasible because they won't cooperate with you, and, you know, depending on the age of the child, their cognitive development won't allow them to follow any commands and cooperate with sedation and topicalization that may be necessary. And I think furthermore, you know, children have the airway anatomy is in transition from birth to adulthood, and depending on what stage they're at, you have a smaller airway, you have a higher located glottis that can present challenges during intubation. And then there's just a movement during the intubation, the movement of the airway, so you're operating in a smaller space that's moving. And finally, the airway reactivity of the pediatric airway is significantly greater than the adult airway. So things like laryngospasm, coughing, bronchospasm are more likely. And so traditionally the thinking has been that children should be intubated under general anesthesia, even if they have anatomy that suggests that they may be challenging to intubate with direct laryngoscopy.
So in the title, you talk about using the Pediatric Difficult Intubation Registry. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, the Pediatric Difficult Intubation Registry, also known as the PD Registry, is a registry that was created back in 2011, and it's a collaboration of currently about a little over 45 centers internationally that collect data about outcomes in children with difficult airways. So in 2010 and 2011, a small group of us met at the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia meeting and started by defining terms and defining data collection elements that we were interested in, and set up this registry that started off with about three centers and has now grown to over 45 centers. So we established standard definitions and agreed on standard auditing procedures of the data and generate monthly reports that give individual site data and benchmark data. So that started in 2011. And as you can imagine, over the years, we've accumulated a large number of cases in that registry. So that registry formed the basis for this study.
Was this a randomized prospective trial?
No, this was a retrospective cohort study. What we did was we used propensity score matching. So we looked at patients who were matched across the groups according to certain demographic factors.
So people are just putting the information in this registry, and then periodically someone, or this is the first time that you've tried to get data out to look at something?
No, so we have performed several studies, and, you know, when we started the registry, we had come up with a list of questions that we thought were important to answer around difficult airway management. And so we've published several studies from this registry and data set. The time periods are often separate, but some of the papers do overlap some other papers, and we try to be clear about that in each of the studies. And in this specific one, as I was saying, we looked at a specific time period and looked at those who were sedated and those who had general anesthesia. We try to match the demographics and characteristics of the patients in the sedated group to the general anesthesia group, so physical exam, history, and weight and age, and then look to see how the outcomes were different when you were sedated versus general anesthesia. So it's not a randomized study. We can't make any claims about causation, but we can identify some associations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Sempow, how commonly do anesthesiologists encounter children who are difficult to mask and, I guess, or intubate?
Well, in children, difficult mask ventilation and intubation are unfortunately more common than we pediatric anesthesiologists would like them to be. A study conducted at McGill University in 484 children ages 0 to 8 years found an unexpected difficult mask ventilation rate of 6.6%. In that study, difficult mask ventilation was defined as two or more of the following events: application of continuous positive airway pressure greater than 5 centimeters in water, use of an oral nasal airway, need for two-person ventilation, desaturation less than 95%, or unanticipated need to increase the inspired fraction of oxygen. All those sort of paint that picture of a unfortunately difficult to mask ventilate patient. You know, in general, pediatric populations are talking about rates of difficult tracheal intubation that have been observed. In the McGill study and a separate study from the University Hospital Erlangen in Germany, those rates of difficult tracheal intubation were reassuringly low, 1.2 and 1.35% respectively. And recently, for neonates, a difficult intubation rate of 5.8% was observed from the European Multicenter Observational Trial known as Nectarine, or Neonate and Children Audit of Anesthesia Practice in Europe. However, it's important to note that the definition of difficult intubation differs across these studies. You see, could potentially factor into these different rates that reported. For example, the Nectarine trial's definition for difficult intubation was just 2 failed attempts at direct laryngoscopy, whereas a difficult intubation in the McGill study was defined as more than 3 intubation attempts, more than 3, right, along with other criteria such as total intubation time greater than 5 minutes.
Hmm. So, Dr. Fanjo, can you tell us like what ages you actually included in this study and some of those comments that Dr. Sempow made about neonates seeming to be higher rates? What are the rates of difficulties with airway management across different age groups?
All of our data seems to suggest that the smaller you are, the more challenging airway management tends to be in the difficult airway population and the more complications we see. So age definitely does matter. And like I had mentioned, the airway is in transition and is in a higher location the younger the patient. So I think that compounded with the size of the airway can make things more challenging. And I just wanted to make a point to what Dr. Sempow said about the variability of definitions. It's one of the big challenges in this type of research is that, you know, when you look at publications, you really have to analyze how they've defined various terms. And with a PE registry, we've been very consistent and have standard definitions, but you'll find across the literature that, you know, what someone defines as a difficult intubation may vary depending on what you look at. There's certainly a need for maybe some consensus around that.
Thanks for pointing that out. Dr. Sempow, can you tell us what you mean by the phrase walk a tightrope or burn a bridge that you used in the title of your editorial?
The phrase walk a tightrope refers to the challenge of providing sedation that is just right, kind of like baby bear's bed, just right, deep enough for a patient to tolerate airway management, yet light enough to maintain adequate spontaneous ventilation, or wake the patient if the intubation just can't be accomplished. And inducing general anesthesia, particularly with a neuromuscular blocking agent, kind of what burns that bridge to the rapid resumption of spontaneous ventilation and a quick wake-up.
Dr. Fiedro, you note that I think proponents of sedated intubation highlight the safety of maintaining spontaneous ventilation and the ability to wake the patient if intubation is impossible as advantages over intubation under GA. But one can maintain spontaneous ventilation even under general anesthesia, right? Especially if a mass conduction is performed?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You can, and many people do. I think your margins are a little different when you're under general anesthesia versus being sedated. I think that's probably the difference. And I usually utilize a sedated intubation based on my ability to rescue the patient. So our typical rescue techniques are the laryngeal mask airway or the nasal trumpet for oxygenation. And if I feel one of those routes is compromised, I can't open the mouth, there's a stenotic nair, I then prefer a sedated approach, and I also get additional help in the event that there's a need for a more invasive access to the airway, which is rare. But those are the kind of situations where I think about that. But yeah, your margin is a little different, I think, if you're sedated versus if you're under general anesthesia. But general anesthesia for intubation is kind of the probably standard approach.
So tell us again, what ages did you include in this study? And I know you mentioned about the time period, but can you tell us again what time period you drew this?
Yeah, so the time period was from 2017 to 2020. And that time period corresponded with the latest updates to our registry data collection elements. That's why we selected that time frame. We just had more detailed data. And the ages in general for the PD registry are patients less than 18 years of age. However, for this study, most of the patients, I think, we didn't report the ages in the paper, but the median weight was 18 kilos. So that gives you the sense that we had infants and toddlers mostly in the study.
And how many patients did you end up with?
We had a total of 1839 patients, 75 of them were sedated, and they were matched 5-to-1 to GA patients, so there were 1,764 general anesthesia patients.
Dr. Sempow, do we have any previous information on the management of difficult airways in children?
We do, yes. We have quite a bit of information on the management of difficult airways in children, thanks actually to the Pediatric Difficult Intubation Collaborative and other researchers. So the PD registry has given rise to numerous clinically relevant studies on various aspects of pediatric difficult airway management, including rates of complications, device comparisons, impact of neuromuscular blocking agent use, and ventilation technique. In fact, the 2022 ASA difficult airway algorithm in pediatric patients was published in Anesthesiology's January 2022 issue. You'll see a familiar name, Dr. John Fiaggio, and other colleagues from the PD Collaborative who played an integral role in developing that algorithm.
Dr. Fiaggio, how were these patients typically sedated?
That's a great question, and one that we discussed when we were writing this manuscript. The common techniques, the most common, were midazolam, dexmedetomidine, and ketamine. Some clinicians used combinations of those drugs, midazolam and ketamine, midazolam and dexmedetomidine, fentanyl and ketamine, and propofol and midazolam. So there were several combinations My favorite approach is midazolam and dexmedetomidine. I found that to be quite effective once titrated to effect with topicalization of the airway. So that's what happened in the sedation patients. In the general anesthesia patients, most of them received sevoflurane with spontaneous ventilation.
And what did you consider a complication?
Yeah, so the P collaborative defined a standard set of complications. We really broke things down into two groups. We defined non-severe complications, and then we defined severe complications. And the non-severe complications were minor airway trauma, esophageal intubation that was immediately recognized if you had epistaxis, if you had pharyngeal bleeding, hypoxemia, bronchospasm, laryngospasm, vomiting, and arrhythmia, and you could argue some of these are severe. The severe complications we considered major airway trauma, esophageal intubation that was not recognized immediately, aspiration, pneumothorax, cardiac arrest, and death. So those were the complications we looked at.
And Dr. Sempel, we know it's not always clear when a patient moves from sedation to general anesthesia. From this registry, can we be certain that the sedation group and the general anesthesia groups were really different for all patients, or do you think there could have been some overlap?
Yeah, this is a great question. You know, from this registry, can't be entirely certain that the sedation group and the general anesthesia groups were different for all patients. And here, I must credit Dr. Amitava, who brought up this point when three of us were writing this editorial. There actually absolutely could have been some overlap in the sedation and general anesthesia groups, you know, trying to differentiate between deep sedation and light, quote-unquote, general anesthesia. How does one do that, especially, say, in an infant or a toddler in the middle of an intubation? And you know, Dr. Piaggio, Dr. Sicaro Ramos, and colleagues, they admitted these limitations fairly in the discussion section. They mentioned that and admitted that the registry does not capture the level of sedation and the timing and dosages of drugs to infer this sort of depth.
Dr. Fiaggio, were you able to determine the methods of intubation and the devices that were used? And if so, what were these, and did they differ between the general anesthetic and sedation groups?
Yes, we had very good data about the techniques that were used for each attempt, and we report the first attempt device in our paper, and they were very different. And clearly a limitation of our study in that there was a tendency to use more flexible fiber optic bronchoscopy in the sedation group. So that was one important difference, and more video laryngoscopy in the general anesthesia group. So there were differences based on technique.
And what did you find?
Our primary outcome was the first attempt success rate of intubation within the sedated group versus the general anesthesia group. And for that, we didn't find any major differences in first attempt success rate. We also looked at complication rates, and the complication rates were very low and no different. What was interesting was that there were no failed intubations in the sedation group. However, there were 6 failed intubations in the general anesthesia group, which was interesting, not statistically significant, but I think clinically interesting to note. The interesting piece of that is several of the sedated patients had to be converted to general anesthesia to successfully complete the intubation. So some patients just wouldn't tolerate the sedation, and about 27% of the sedated patients ended up being converted to general anesthesia. So the fact that there were no failed intubations in the sedation group has to be considered in the context of needing to convert them to general anesthesia.
Sintal, I think that you do not necessarily agree with the conclusions that the authors arrived at, or as you write, the quote, statement of equipoise, which I must say is refreshing terminology in a scientific paper. Can you tell us more about how you interpret the findings?
Dr. Smetava Davidson, I, in the end, did agree with the author's conclusion that the study did not point to one approach being superior to the other. However, we took this editorial as an opportunity to emphasize that in this study, sedation was very infrequently used compared to general anesthesia, as Dr. Fiaggio has mentioned, and the failure rate of sedation was, we all agreed, pretty high, surprisingly high. So should we all keep calm and carry on with our more familiar technique and sort of shrug because neither was deemed superior in the study? Or should we interpret this study as a call and challenge to develop skills and experience with both sedation and general anesthesia? Perhaps sedation should be used more frequently, get more people comfortable with it, using it, and empower a study that is perhaps arrives at a different conclusion, or carry out a prospective study comparing the two approaches.
So I guess like all good studies, it asks more questions or prompts one to do further research. Dr. Fiaggio, it's not unusual for children to be intubated without the use of neuromuscular blocking agents, right? Were you able to determine the use of these agents and the effects on the ability to intubate these kids?
We did look at the use of neuromuscular blocking drugs and found that in almost 50% of the general anesthesia group, a neuromuscular blocking drug was given. And then in the sedated patients that got converted to general anesthesia, I think there were about 16 of those, five of them received a neuromuscular blocking drug. So about 50% of clinicians used neuromuscular blocking agents. Now, the efficacy of those neuromuscular blocking drugs was not really a focus of this study, but we have done previous studies that suggest, and several others suggest, that using a neuromuscular blocking drug facilitates tracheal intubation. I think there is some clinician judgment that's involved in certain circumstances in patients who have large obstructing lesions. It's prudent to keep them spontaneously ventilating. But if you encounter airway reactivity and the inability to ventilate a patient, you should always consider, I believe, and this is aside from the study, this is just me sharing my opinion, you should consider giving a neuromuscular blocking drug. And, you know, if you're heading towards a surgical airway, that may improve the situation. But yes, 50% of the general anesthesia group received a neuromuscular blocking agent.
Do you think pediatric anesthesiologists are reluctant to give neuromuscular blocking agents, or why is there seem to be a much lower use of those than in adults?
I think that's one of the mantras that I was taught as a trainee, was never to paralyze a patient or burn a bridge, like Dr. Simpal says, when you're managing these challenging airways. I think there's enough data that suggests that burning that bridge may facilitate success in many patients. There are probably a small fraction of patients who may be made worse by giving that neuromuscular blocking drug, and we focus on those patients and, in a sense, have a cognitive bias to not using those drugs. But I think with the data, we need to better define which populations benefit and which populations may be harmed by a neuromuscular blocking drug. But I think regardless, if you get to a position where you cannot ventilate and oxygenate and you are considering a surgical airway, or that's your next step, you should give a muscle relaxant. And I'm sure some people may disagree. I'd love to have that debate.
We love it when we're provocative on this podcast. Dr. Simpal, you mentioned something in your editorial that I was not previously familiar with, a directed acrylic graph, or DAG. What is that?
I have to admit, on the same page that you were, we were writing this editorial. So I have to give credit to my co-author, Dr. Davidson, whose fantastic idea it was to include directed acyclic graphs in our editorial. And these graphs are a perfect example of a picture being worth 1,000 words, but I'm still going to take a few anyway to try to describe them. So directed acyclic graphs are visual representations of causal structures. And these graphs visually capture the interrelationships between exposure and outcome variables. And arrows are used to represent the causal relationships. The graphs are used and offer a robust framework to discover causal effects and identify and address sources of bias. Basically, summed up is graphing the exposure and outcome variables using arrows to represent those relationships. And I highly recommend the Reader's Toolbox article in the May 2020 issue of Anesthesiology. Doctors Gaskell and Slay delve into causal diagrams. They use anesthesia-related illustrations and examples. The article is available free on the Anesthesiology Journal website, and they do a far better job of explaining these than I do.
Thank you for giving our readers that reference. Dr. Fiaggio, did any of these patients have surgery canceled to require surgical rescue airways? And you mentioned about how some of the sedation patients were converted to general to manage their airway. Were there any general anesthetic patients that they woke up and then managed their airways?
That's a great question, and I actually don't recall whether we had that situation, but I do recall that we did have a couple of patients that required surgical airways. And I unfortunately don't remember the numbers, but I think we did.
Dr. Sempau, you raise an interesting concept, and I believe challenge the notion that I thought was one of those set-in-stone conceptions that a retrospective study can never prove causation. Can you explain to our readers what you wrote?
Yeah, thank you. With respect to retrospective studies, association still does not necessarily equal causation. Praise still stands. However, to quote Hernan and Robbins, whose work we cite as reference number 9 in our editorial, in the area of large observational data sets, we can resort to observational analyses of existing data because the randomized trial that would answer our question, the target trial, quote, is not feasible, ethical, or timely, and use these observational analyses to emulate a variety of target trials. So, as described in the editorial, a researcher imagines that they are performing a randomized controlled trial, and that researcher applies the appropriate design principles, such as eligibility criteria, assignment procedures, determines outcomes and defines them, and comes up with an analysis plan. And then the target trial protocol is emulated using the large observational data set. And, you know, this is obviously, a simplified summary of the concept of big data and target trials. And Hernan and Robbins do a fantastic job explaining this concept. There are numerous examples of this approach in the peer-reviewed literature. I encourage your listeners to visit them on PubMed, just looking for target trials, and see a whole host of different examples in different fields of medicine.
Dr. Fiaggio, I know you've shared a bit about your approach to managing airways, but can you just maybe close here with telling us how you like to manage children with anticipated difficult airways?
Would love to. I just wanted to circle back to your earlier question about surgical airways. So in the general anesthesia group, I looked up the numbers. There were 6 patients that failed intubation. In 2 of them, the planned procedure was continued with a supraglottic airway, and 4 patients were awakened and their procedure was canceled or rescheduled. I never say canceled. We can only reschedule. So that was the data regarding that, and no surgical airways in that group. Now, as to my approach to an anticipated difficult airway, my first question usually is, can I rescue this patient? Meaning, are the nasal passages open and patent? Is the mouth opening adequate for rescue, to put a supraglottic airway in, to put a nasal trumpet in? Those are our primary rescue mechanisms for oxygenation and ventilation. If one of those is compromised, so the mouth opening is severely limited and the nasal passages are small, or there's a history of a nasal deviation, I get very concerned, because if I get into trouble trying to intubate through that nose and get into bleeding, my visualization techniques may be obscured. So I often will, if I only have one rescue approach, I often will have a otolaryngologist available for a potential surgical airway. And I often pick a sedated approach versus general anesthesia. And my sedation approach is to use titrated doses of midazolam and dexmedetomidine followed by an infusion, and then I topicalize the airway. And I have found this technique to be very effective, and, you know, in some teenagers who can follow along, my colleagues and I have taken care of some of these children, and they'll give you a thumbs up after they're intubated, which is always the desired outcome. Doesn't always happen, but sometimes you get there. But the combination of midazolam and dexmedetomidine has been very effective for me. I try not to include other drugs because then the synergy of the drugs may make it more likely that your patient may become over-sedated. I don't know if Dr. Simpao has anything else to add.
No, I learned from the best, Dr. John Piaggio. So
you'll get the check afterwards.
All joking aside, I did learn a tremendous amount from Dr. Piaggio when he was my attending, and I was his fellow. However, I absolutely follow the same goal, same plan, and always having a plan B, C, D, and E, and phoning a friend. You know, not being too proud to have another anesthesiologist, an ENT surgeon colleague, someone else with expertise to help bail out and save lives.
So another reason for attendings to treat their residents and fellows well, so when they write future editorials about their research papers, they will be kind. So I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read these important articles to learn more. Thank you, Drs. Piaggio and Simpao, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.